I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Mira Sorvino. She's an award-winning actress, and she's the United Nations Office of Drugs and Crime Goodwill Ambassador to Combat Human Trafficking. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, thank you.
So how did you become aware of, and above all, involved in, the fight against human trafficking and modern-day slavery?
I was Amnesty International Stop Violence Against Women campaign spokesperson for 3 years, starting in 2004. And one of the topics that we covered under the overall arching canopy of violence towards women in the world was human trafficking, because 79% of its victims are women and girls. And I was frankly stunned to learn that slavery was thriving. It was alive and well, but in an illegal form underground rather than the legalized chattel slavery that we had in the 19th century here.
We talked on this program about the subject during the Santa Fe Film Festival in connection with the film Little Dancer, and you have recently, this year, made a movie called Trade of Innocence, which can be found on the web, tradeofinnocencethemovie.com. I was just watching that last night, and I think it's very important just to keep this subject in focus in the media. Give us a sense of how big this problem is and what it looks like in and outside the U.S.
Well, worldwide, I've recently heard our ambassador at large for the State Department, Louis C. DeBaca, the United States State Department, say that that he believes that there are between 21 to 29 million people living in slavery today in the world. And he is a very, very, very well-researched man, and I would not take his figures lightly. And those figures coincide with several other groups, the more conservative being the 21 million and the high end being the 29. But it's huge. It's really, really gigantic. And in our country, every state has human trafficking, and it divides about 50-50 between labor and sex trafficking. And the sex trafficking is dominated numbers-wise by our own domestic minors who are being bought and sold to the tune of 1 to 300,000 kids, American kids, at any given time. And that's something that the general public doesn't really understand. When they think of human trafficking, they think mistakenly that it involves crossing borders, that it has to involve a geographic movement, and it doesn't. All it has to involve is compelling people to work by force and threat, generally not paying them much at all, if anything, and restricting their movement. So, and with the case of underage kids being sold for sex, you don't even have to prove force, fraud, or coercion, because no person under the age of 18 has the legal or psychological or mental capacity to consent to their own exploitation. They're just not there yet. So they are being victimized, whether they even understand that or not.
And yet there is a kind of history in this country, and you can, I don't know whether this is, how much this is changing, of even if, for example, a girl is underage, she's the one who's arrested, whereas the John, who really should be arrested for statutory rape, walks.
Yeah, I've just given a very, very lengthy speech at the National Conference of State Legislators in which I made a very, very big push for more demand-side laws to be put in place, that the Johns really need to be punished, and that this old, you know, notion that, oh, well, boys will be boys, they're always going to do that, so we can't stop them, so we have to, you know, stop the child that they're sleeping with, is insane. And Johns have been polled, and they've been asked what would make them stop. And something like 79 or 80% of them said if their car was impounded, they would stop buying commercial sex. Another big deterrent would be a letter sent home. I mean, we're not even talking like prison time or, you know, major fines. We're talking just the shame or inconvenience would stop them. Right. And in California, there's a good law. It's sadly not yet quite being put into use, but it charges a mandatory $25,000 fine to a man who's bought sex from a minor, and that money goes directly into a fund for victim services. So I'm trying to look here at the Polaris Project State Ratings website. It actually rates every state in terms of how they're doing on anti-trafficking legislation, and I'm looking at New Mexico, and you guys are yellow. And yellow is tier two. It's the second best. Green is the best. No state in the country has all the laws that it needs. but I would definitely recommend to your listeners to go to the Polaris Project website and look at the state ratings chart, and there they'll see 10 different categories by which states are kind of considered in terms of how they're doing, and you can look up New Mexico and see what you don't have yet and how to support those laws being written by lobbying your state legislators. So I'm seeing, okay, you have a sex trafficking law, you have a labor trafficking law, you don't have asset forfeiture and or investigative tools laws, meaning that you don't have a law that, like with drug traffickers, there's asset forfeiture that's done immediately, because these criminals are very good at hiding their money. So you have to be able to seize their car and their property and their trucks and sort of shut them down that way, and then also use the benefits from the sale of those to help victims and to help fund the cases against them. Let's see what else. You do have some training required and or a human trafficking task force, but a huge, huge tool in the fight against human trafficking is to train law enforcement, the judiciary staff, the prosecutorial staff, the public defender staff on human trafficking. It is so essential because it really, really raises the number of discovery of victims and arrest and prosecution and conviction of traffickers. And it stops the impunity, and it saves lives. And because people who don't really understand what trafficking is, and that's a lot of people out there, including a lot of law enforcement, a lot of people in the legal profession, they'll miss the signs. They won't right. know who is a victim. They won't know how to treat them. And often they'll treat them like a criminal, and they'll miss the fact that that person is actually a modern-day slave. But not only, and this is my big push, not only should those areas be covered in terms of training, but anyone who works in civil society or for the government and is in the position of being a first responder, such as, you know, obviously medical staff, paramedics, the travel industry, people in hotels, people in the foster care industry, people in the social work industry. Everyone needs to get this training course to be part of their education, to be part of their job description or their completion of their accreditation, because people surface for a second. You know, a girl will have a broken jaw because she's been punched by a trafficker. He'll bring her into the emergency room. She'll be alone with a doctor for 5 minutes, or a paramedic or a nurse. Those 5 minutes could save her life. If not, she goes right back underground. So this training business is incredibly important. The other big, big thing, which if you care about kids in trafficking, is the safe harbor laws. And right now, only 11 states have them. And what they are is basically a law that decriminalizes children and teenagers in commercial sexual exploitation, and instead puts the big penalties on the traffickers and makes these minors eligible for services. Because right now, crazily, in most states, unless you were trafficked by a member of your family, you are not considered a victim of extreme child abuse or neglect. So you get nothing. You get no housing, you get no counseling, you get no medical care, you're not entitled to any services whatsoever. And obviously a person who's been through the trauma of slavery needs a ton of help to be rehabilitated, to become, you know, a productive, happy member of society. And believe you me, when they get this help, I've seen incredible, incredible courage and amazing positive lives being lived out by these people who were formerly in horrendous situations and who are now helping others, but they need that help. And the safe harbor laws give them that, and the safe harbor laws expunge their criminal records so that they don't follow them the rest of their life, something that was actually done to them rather than them doing it to someone else. They're not the criminals, they're the victims. The safe harbor law sets that up in the state statute, that they are not the criminals, that the pimps and the Johns are the criminals. So that, in terms of what you were talking about, is so, so important, as is the posting of the national human trafficking hub, which saves a lot of lives too, which you guys don't have either.
We're talking to Mira Sorvino. I mean, I think that it's so stunning to me that these girls, first of all, can be victimized and then not seen as being victims and continue to be abused by the system. And it seems like there's such a deep underlying both sexism and kind of the Madonna whore complex. If you are in any way not a pure girl, you're trash. And this permeates the mindset of people so that it makes it so much harder to solve the problem.
Well, I think it's also just that they've been seen under this prostitution lens for a long, long time, and we no longer call them child prostitutes. We call them victims of human trafficking, because the child prostitute suggests that that's something that they have chosen that they do, rather than something that's being done to them and that they're being exploited and used. But, you know, there's a ton of faith-based groups out there who are very, very passionate about helping these kids. And they're not just girls. There's boys, too. And there's so little help for the boys. There's, like, no shelter beds out there, whatever, and very, very, very few for young women. There's the services side of this, the spaces available for them in programs to help them are minute in comparison to the large number of them. And be aware, too, that so much of this crime nowadays happens on the Internet. There's places like MyRedBook.com or RentBoy or all of these different sites where kids can be purchased anonymously in a way or sold anonymously, and the trafficker will put up a number of ads for them on the site and then gauge where the most interest is for that child and then travel them geographically to wherever there seems to be the most people who want to use that kid's services, and sometimes they'll service 30 and 40 people a day. I mean, it's horrendous. But all of this, given its proper, you know, attention, people can't forget the labor side of trafficking, because being a slave is being a slave. So, and if you think that women in labor trafficking aren't suffering sexual abuse, that you would be wrong. Every woman who's in labor trafficking usually gets repeatedly raped. And the men get beaten and often killed. And, you know, they're terrified for their families, because that's the key tool that the traffickers use, is they threaten the families of the trafficked people. And sometimes they carry out those threats. Sometimes they do kill the people back home or burn down their house or, you know, follow them to school. And so people live sometimes trapped in this kind of Stockholm syndrome, like, you know, obedience to the trafficker, because they want to help out their families. They want to make sure they keep them safe. And, you know, a lot of the labor trafficking is foreign nationals being brought in, and their passports are confiscated by the traffickers, and they don't usually speak the language. And they're terrified that they will be treated as criminals if they are found out, because the traffickers inculcate in them a terror of the police and of jails, because a lot of them come from countries where the police are much more corrupt, too. And so, you know, it's this vicious cycle of just kind of keeping them in bondage through so many different methods. And people can't forget the labor trafficking victims, because, as I said, it skews about 50-50 in this country. So I'm sure that there's migrant farm workers in New Mexico, there's sweatshop laborers, there's janitorial staff. In California recently, there was a huge scandal with elder care facilities, assisted living facilities, where the entire staff were composed of trafficking victims from the Philippines who were beaten, who were not allowed to leave the facilities, who were not barely fed or paid, and they had been licensed by three different licensing agencies, but they were looking for the patient staff ratio rather than labor abuses of the staff. So you can find ways to traffic almost anybody to do almost anything. It's crazy.
Well, and I think it's so important to raise awareness of this, because just as, I mean, around, you know, in the 1950s and 60s, there was so little awareness of domestic abuse, and there were all these women and children and everything being beaten up in their own homes, and the police didn't have the eyes to see it. We're looking pretty much at the same kind of situation for human trafficking now, and
well,
I was wondering,
I mean... We can look at the domestic abuse situation as a hopeful model. To say, okay, we wised up, we recognized the signs, and now women are not as afraid in their own homes. And I think that, you know, we can make that countrywide shift towards understanding human trafficking as well.
You've been in a couple of films, Trade of Innocence, as we talked about, and another film called Human Trafficking, and I wondered what kind of perspective you have gotten on this whole subject by actually acting in these movies and developing the characters.
Well, I think, you know, in the first movie, I interviewed the human trafficking. I interviewed ICE agents, you know, who are the specialized law enforcement who work on human trafficking in immigration and customs enforcement. And then I started interviewing victims. And that's when my whole world really kind of changed, is when I started meeting actual victims and survivors of human trafficking. And they blew me away with what they had been through, but also their courage and integrity and just personhood. But I could not believe that people had been treated the way they had been. When you talk to them, you can't believe that someone is kept under lock and key and beaten and raped and told that their family is going to be killed and that they're worthless, that they have no value on this earth. And, you know, treated, you know, one of them was told, in this country, you're lower than a dog. If you escape, the police will catch you and they'll throw, you know, they'll lock you up and throw away the key. And you're lower than a dog here. People in this country care about animals. They've got whole societies for their protection. Nobody here cares about you. And, you know, sadly, sort of by default, in a way, that's true because they're like this silent victim pool that people don't even know about. So, ergo, they don't care about them because they don't know that they're there. And, you know, what we're trying to do is make people understand that they're there and get the appropriate laws and then the appropriate money into the services side of it so that they can be helped, you know, so that it's understood as this big, big problem that really does exist in America in a big way, not just in other countries.
Let's talk for a moment again about the people who are actually paying for sex with children, with, as you mentioned, both girls and boys, although predominantly girls. Who are these people? Are they pedophiles?
They're average American guys. There's 15 million of them. Most of them are white middle class.
And is it possible?
Most of them are white middle class, live in suburbs, and have families. That's the profile, which is insane. You know, but also, some of them are pedophiles. And if you think about it, what's easier? Renting a white panel van, kidnapping the neighbor and keeping him in your basement while you abuse him, or paying $25 on an internet site and having sex with a child in virtual safety? Because if, and it's a huge if the act is ever caught by the police, the John in like zero cases out of 300 in terms of an NGO worker that I just spoke to a few weeks ago, she said that in 300 cases that she'd worked with children being brought in for being caught in the act, not one time was the John arrested, not once. So a pedophile is smart, and they're like, well, $25 is a lot cheaper than being a permanent member of the sex offender registry and going to jail. I think I'll go this route. So, yes, right. You have both. You have guys who just want an experience, and the taste is skewing for younger and younger product because they think it's fresher, and they're also, you know, one policeman told me he felt that the internet is so rife with crazy images of depravity that basically people want more and more extreme experiences, so they will skew younger with the people that they're trying to buy. But there's also, you know, fear of AIDS, fear of STDs, and people tend to think a younger person will have less of a chance of giving them that.
Now, is there treatment available for these, especially, I mean, these people who really seem to have a big problem? I mean, that kind of pedophilia and that kind of abuse, do they seek treatment, and is there treatment?
As far as I understand it, people who are true pedophiles, there's no treatment. There's medical castration and there's imprisonment. There's no cure for true sex offender pedophilia. I think people who are casual Johns who would also sleep with a person over 18 and is just looking to, you know, have that experience, I don't know. I mean, there's John School, and John School has been laughed at and thought of as something that is just a slap on the wrist, and it is in terms of the severity of the crime in our eyes. But in the reality of things, when men are sent to John School for a day or 3 days, and it's usually a place where they're lectured to by former prostitutes who tell them the you know, damage that it's done to them, 40% of them don't buy sex anymore commercially. So that does help. You know, but I think it's also just a cultural thing that fathers need to step up and say, son, this isn't how we have fun anymore, because it's not fun for the person who's being bought, whose body's being exploited and degraded. And, it's not a victimless crime, and we don't celebrate this one anymore. We don't celebrate rites of passage with a visit to a whorehouse. We don't do that anymore, because we're men that respect women. We're not men that tear them down.
What do you do as UN Goodwill Ambassador?
Because this is the American side, basically, which I do on my own. As Goodwill Ambassador, we travel to different countries around the world, and I've been, you know, very lucky to be part of something called the Blue Heart Campaign, which is sort of like the Red Ribbon for AIDS, but it's a Blue Heart for anti-trafficking. And we've had big events in Mexico, in Spain, in England. I did a joint event with the UNODC office in Thailand while I was making Trade of Innocence, where we gave a big, big, big press conference, and members of the government were there. And my sneak ended up being handed to the Minister of the Interior. And, you know, we try and talk to the people in power, but also liaise with NGOs and not only raise awareness, but try and influence policy and share best practices from the ground with those people who are making the laws and then hopefully enacting them. But there's a big gap usually between the writing of a law and then its actual enactment on the ground and being put into use in its most robust form. And that's where that training comes in that we were talking about. But another thing is, I was recently part of a drafting session of the UN's Global Plan of Action to Combat Human Trafficking, which was a sort of a practical roadmap for countries who want to fight human trafficking, who are probably already signatory to the Palermo Protocol, which is the big trafficking protocol, but that want to know exactly really how to do it. And it's a big document, and it really goes through step-by-step ways to combat trafficking on the ground and what laws they need to have and how they need to work together and how civil society and state actors have to work together and NGOs have to work together and things like the period of reflection, which is not used hardly anywhere in the States, which it really should be. It's actually been enacted more thoroughly abroad, which basically says if someone is suspected of being a human trafficking, they should be given a minimum of a 30-day period of reflection before they're asked to fully cooperate with law enforcement. And they need to be in a safe place, but not a safe place like a detention area. There needs to be a way to separate them from the traffickers so they can recover from the trauma and get over their fear of the traffickers before they're interrogated, before they're asked to really participate fully in a criminal investigation, before they're deported. Sometimes people are deported on site, not even really understood to be trafficking victims. And, you know, the UN strongly suggests this 30-day period of reflection so that the person has the chance to recover to the extent that they can talk about their experience and not be re-traumatized by it and not lie out of fear that the trafficker is going to kill them the next day.
Right.
So that was, you know, that's just an example of one of the things in the Global Plan of Action. So that was passed by the General Assembly. And then we also have something called the UN Voluntary Trust Fund for Victims of Human Trafficking, which is this amazing fund that if anyone here has some end-of-year cash and they want to donate it and get the tax deduction, it's this scrupulously vetted fund that gives money directly to NGOs that work with victims. And most funds actually don't go for the services. They go more for advocacy, which is great, but I'm an advocate and I do it for free. So that can be done for free, but you can't build beds for children in Pattaya, Thailand in a dormitory for free. You can't feed them for free. You can't give them psychological and medical help for free. And the NGOs around the world are doing the work of the angels. They're really literally rescuing people every single day, risking their own lives and rebuilding lives and making the world a less slavery-filled place, one person at a time. So that's an amazing thing to donate to if people are interested in that. And it's the UN Human Trafficking Fund, I think, is the way that you would find it on the web if you Google that. But it's really great, and they give to NGOs all over the world. One of them happens to be in California. They're all different countries, and they have a very tough admissions process where they, you know, look at over 800 applicants a year. But that's something that I could really recommend. So.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being on the program with us. Mira Sorvino is an Academy Award-winning actress, and she's United Nations Office of Drugs and Crime Goodwill Ambassador to Combat Human Trafficking. Thank you so much for what you do and for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you so much.
I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Jeff Orlowski. He is the director of the documentary Chasing ICE, which opens today at the CCA here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
So this is an amazing, kind of thrilling to watch documentary about a photographer named James Balog. He's the subject of this documentary. Who is he, and how did you connect with him?
Yeah, I met James through a mutual friend, and he's an incredible photographer. He's done a lot of work for National Geographic and Time and The New Yorker. And I met him right when he was starting to work on this project to install time-lapse cameras all around the world. His goal was to document these glaciers in the Northern Hemisphere over multiple years and see what they would do. I just wanted to work with James as a photographer because that was my background and my interest, and I knew this was a really compelling, interesting project, and so I went with him on his first trip to Iceland. We installed 5 cameras in Iceland, and then we continued from there, and we put cameras in Greenland, in Alaska, Glacier National Park, and at this point, we now have a 5-year record of what the ice all around the Arctic has done, and James has this, you know, irrefutable evidence that's documented these glaciers changing very, very dramatically in a short period of time.
He had this insight, and I think it's such an important thing to talk about, that in order to tell the story of climate change, it's really essential that the visual story be told, not just the sort of computer modeling and all the things that scientists understand, but actually to tell this visual story. And the idea of actually putting time-lapse cameras on glaciers was what he came up with, which is absolutely brilliant, and also really hard. I mean, this was a whole engineering feat, and the movie ends up being kind of an adventure story.
Right, most definitely. The technology didn't exist at all for James to accomplish this. He had to invent the technology to do it. And your point is really valid because, you know, James was actually a skeptic about climate change. He wasn't sure if humans could influence the planet, as some of the scientists were talking about, you know, 20 years ago. So he was skeptical of it, and he learned from the science that it was happening, that it was a reality. He did his own research and looked into the peer-reviewed literature and saw that it was happening. But he recognized that most people aren't going to go to that effort. So he wanted to figure out how can he make it visual, how can he communicate and document, you know, as a photojournalist, what's up with the story and where's the truth in the story here. And what he realized, you know, climate change is it's an invisible subject. It's impossible to see how temperature or carbon dioxide are changing in the air. You can't see those actual changes. So what James wanted to figure out was, as a photographer, how could he make this invisible subject visible and tangible? And the way he figured out how to do it was in the ice. And so we followed him on this journey and this expedition, and it really is. It's a true adventure. It's like a modern-day Indiana Jones story. That's kind of how I think of it. You know, James is out there trying to do his research, trying to collect this imagery and this evidence and bring it back to the world to share it with the public.
And of course, part of the story is the story of the poor guy's knees, which are like giving out throughout the whole film.
Yeah, when we were working on the story and editing it, we had over 400 hours of footage available to us. There were over 1 million still photographs and over 400 hours of video footage. And when we were editing the story, we wanted to figure out in a similar way, how do you take this story and how do you make it emotional? And what we really concluded was we needed James's personal story to be a big part of that. There's a little bit of his family in there. There's a little bit of his own physical struggles that he goes through. And more than anything, it's really a testament to the degree to which James was willing to risk himself to make this project happen. There are probably half a dozen different life-threatening instances that happened over the course of the 5 years that we were out there shooting, and a couple of them are captured and they're in the film, and it really just is a testament to what James is willing to do, what risk he's willing to put himself at for the sake of his art and for his photography and to document the truth.
One thing that I think is really interesting and important also is that you not only did time-lapse photography, but you had video cameras, and there were some weirdly serendipitous moments where you were able to capture great glacial events just because the crew happened to be there at that moment.
Yeah, certainly. There was one particular event where we were camped out for over a month, or just about a month was the intention of that trip, just to try to capture a big calving event when a piece of ice breaks and falls into the ocean. So we were very fortunate when that happened, that it did happen when we were there. But those events are rare, and we really wanted to document that and share it with the world.
Talk about what calving means.
A calving event is when a piece of ice breaks off a glacier and falls into the ocean. So it happens in any glacier that ends in the ocean, not if it ends in the land. And sometimes they're small. You know, when people see a piece of ice break off in the news, or when they sometimes talk about climate change and you see a piece of ice break off, that is a calving event. But those are typically small events, individual pieces of ice that broke off. We actually set out to film a very large event, and we went to one of the biggest glaciers in Greenland. It's called the Ilulissat Glacier. It's on the western coast of Greenland. And we camped there for a month waiting to see if we would capture a big event. And what we actually filmed was the largest calving event that's ever been filmed. And it's an event that took 75 minutes for the glacier to retreat, and it retreated a full mile over a calving face about 3 miles wide. I mean, unprecedented amount of ice that was documented. It's about the size of Lower Manhattan breaking off and rolling into the ocean. And that's one of the big scenes of the film that people get to see on the big screen.
And also here, I mean, the sound of it, filming it must have been kind of otherworldly.
It is. When a calving event happens, when you're close to those events, it sounds like a 747 is flying right over your head. The rumbling and the intensity is really unlike anything I've experienced from any other natural phenomena by far. That's one of the reasons why we want people to see it on the big screen, because it's an experience in the theater with the sound and with the picture that is, you can't compare that to seeing it, you know, on a laptop or on a home television system.
Right, right. We're talking to Jeff Orlowski about the documentary Chasing Ice. Now, I think it's such an interesting movie to watch because, you know, we watch those kinds of movies that come up during the mountain festivals with extreme skiers and people going off on mountain adventures, and you're sitting there in your chair watching it, and you're terrified, and you're thinking you're going to fall off the mountain even as you're just watching the screen. And it's all kind of in good fun and everything. And you're watching this and have some of the same feelings, but what you're watching is the effect of human beings destroying their planet. And the seriousness and the hugeness of it is almost incomprehensible, but it's right in front of your eyes. And it's very, I mean, it's scary on a level that's almost hard to take in.
Yeah, there's an interesting balance between the beauty and the horror that we've had to kind of think about and process quite a bit over the past 5 years. It is a difficult, horrific subject matter. I mean, there are a lot of different ways that you can talk about climate change that are depressing and sad and dirty, literally dirty in terms of coal or oil or things like that. And what James wanted to do with his photography was figure out how he can make it beautiful and how can he make the subject matter something that's compelling and emotional for people and give them a sense of really what's at risk and what there is that we're, you know, going to lose as a result of man-made climate change. And so what he figured out was to document it in the ice, to make beautiful images of the ice, and that's what we're losing. And that's what we tried to do with the film itself. And there is a very interesting balance of the beauty and horror. And people often come back to us and say, you know, people have said to us that they went to see the movie because they heard it was beautiful and that they were skeptical of climate change. And after seeing the film, they realize now the reality and the significance of the issue, and they're so much more compelled because they felt it emotionally through the photography. And so that, you know, that was really a testament to James's mindset and vision for coming up with this idea to make it, make the story told through this beautiful imagery.
And meanwhile, there are clips of people from Fox News kind of spouting on about how climate change is a hoax, interspersed with these images, which is ironic and sort of painful to look at.
Yes, certainly. And I don't mean to pick anybody out particularly, but it's, you know, there's still a lot of denial and skepticism out there in the general public. And it's unfortunate because we're at a point in history and in culture right now where we need to act on this. It's a very, very urgent issue that we need to act on. And if people are continuing to slow progress down through a set of ideological or political or philosophical, you know, restraints, then we're just doing harm for future generations. It's something that is going to affect all future generations, regardless of your political stance, regardless of your thoughts on whether or not climate change change is happening or not, the scientists are telling us, you know, definitively that it's going to have very significant impacts. We've already seen the impacts of climate change. You know, we have some numbers and information in the film that talks about how climate change has affected just North America alone in the last 30 years. And it's quite a significant rise in the number of events of natural disasters. And this is information coming from insurance companies that are telling us what the financial implications are of climate change. So these are very real, pressing issues, and we need to act on them quickly.
So the film is called Chasing Ice, and the project is called the Extreme Ice Survey. And people can look at both of those online, chasingice.com and extremeicesurvey.org. Is the Extreme Ice Survey, this whole time-lapse photography project, is it ongoing? Do you plan to keep it going indefinitely?
Yes, absolutely. When James first created it, he thought it would be a three-year project. And then in 3 years, he thought it would be a five-year project. And now he's thinking it's a forever project. And we really feel, as a whole team, we feel like we have a responsibility for the cameras to keep shooting. You know, we're documenting history. We're documenting these changing landscapes. And we figured out the technology to be able to capture that. We want the cameras to continue to run as long as they possibly can, because they are a historic record of what's going on the planet and what human civilization is doing to the planet. We have right now, there are 34 cameras shooting at 16 different glaciers. The cameras are in Canada, Glacier National Park, Alaska, Iceland, and Greenland. And James wants to continue documenting other glaciers in South America and in Antarctica as well.
It's also ironic, and this is something that I think about quite often, is that even as we are destroying the planet, we're making this incredible and wonderful and beautiful progress within our civilization. So toward the end of the film, it talks about how his knees are being healed by a kind of stem cell research. And I think the irony of living inside of that progress and that destruction that are happening simultaneously is something that the film really gives rise to our thinking about and talking about.
Yeah, certainly. Thank you. This is a problem that technology, not that technology has created the problem, but technology has certainly fed into it. And the same, you know, mindset that created this problem, it's taken decades and decades for climate change to be realized to the degree it has and will continue to. And it's going to take a long time for it to be resolved. But the only hope we have from a technological perspective is that we do continue to develop and invest in new technologies that are sustainable, that are going to last. That's really what we need to incentivize and prioritize and move forward as quickly as possible on.
Jeff Orlowski is director of the film Chasing Ice, which opens tonight at the CCA here in Santa Fe, ccasantafe.org. The number over there is 505-982-1338. Jeff, before we go, are there any amazing moments or like scariest moments of doing this film that you would like to share with us?
There were, like I said earlier, about half a dozen different life-threatening circumstances. And honestly, in retrospect, those were the things that, not that the life-threatening things were the things that we were chasing, but our whole team, we were, you know, to some degree out there for the adventure of it, too. And we were just really thrilled to have this film come to life and really share James's story and the adventures that we went on as a team to places that nobody gets to go to. We really feel like we wanted to capture the beauty of the ice and the beauty of the Arctic and bring that home for people. I never thought I would go to Iceland or Greenland before working on this film, and it really has just been an incredible treat to be able to go to those places and share them with the world.
Jeff Orlowski, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Yeah, thanks so much.
The film opens tonight, and there are many showings over the next week, but tonight is a very special showing. At 7 o'clock, Jack Loeffler will be there introducing the film and the River Runs Through Us artist team, as well as Felicity Brennan of the Santa Fe Watershed Association and local poets. So there will be a poetry reading as well as a screening, and the event will be followed by dessert and conversation with author, activist, oral historian, and radio producer Jack Loeffler. Again, ccasantafe.org, 982-1338. I'd like to welcome now Stephen Jules Rubin. He is the producer of Jules Work Follies, which is the Santa Fe monthly variety show, and it's happening this Sunday, December 30th at 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks again, Mary Charlotte.
Always and yeah, it's always good to have you. And Jules Work's and this variety show keep moving around, I guess, as you were saying before we went on
the
air. That's showbiz.
That's showbiz. I mean, I don't know how somehow it's been 9 months now. I know we'll make a year, but it's just there was a couple months there where it was kind of smooth. But from the start, that's just how it goes, especially this kind of thing with a lot of great performers. And you know, it's not a money thing. It's meant as a show and a networking thing and for the audience and everyone. So, it, you know, if, even in showbiz, when you have a lot of money for the venue, this stuff happens. So for us, it's, you know, it's just kind of let's make sure it keeps happening. Fortunately, what's happening as far as at first it was like me and everyone else, but me with the energy to do it. Now
right.
Other people are coming too, that it's feeling like a troupe, which is great. It, you know, one thing I want to make sure everyone knows, especially performers, is while it's a troupe that is always open for other people. So
when you say a troupe, I mean, you've got a bunch of different performers who keep coming back. Like, what kind of performers are
you? Yeah, there's people that keep coming back. For one thing, within Jules Works itself, I suppose, I've been writing as we go a serialized play. And some of those actors have come and go, starting from the first month where I had the first read-through scheduled, and then all of a sudden woke up to texts that almost no one could make it.
Oh, no.
But I just, you know, when I announced that the venue had to change last week, is one thing I'm not good at is quitting. I just refuse, especially since we're closing in on a year.
Now, this is at Rouge Cat.
Yeah, we've been at Lucky Bean, and then they just wrote last week that they were told they have 3 days to get out. So,
oh, no.
Yeah, so I had already had some email connection with this Joseph Santapape Phantom Fit. Try that again. With a guy, Joseph Santa Fe Pulse is his name, and he is a promoter, and so he does a lot of events at Rouge Cat, and not just the music. He's working on developing open mics there and other things. So he had already opened the doors, you know, for us, and I knew Lucky Bean wasn't going to last forever. I didn't realize I was going to have 3 days. So anyway, he said, "Sure, let's do it." I went over there that night, and we'll see how it goes there. You know, if it is over 21, you know, does limit.
Which is a shame. I mean, Meow Wolf was here recently talking about the necessity of a really great all-ages venue.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know how that stuff works, but it would be awesome if the upstairs had the bar and the downstairs, but of course they need their bar open to make it worthwhile.
No, I know, but I mean, wristbands and whatever.
Yeah,
I mean, that's another conversation. But anyway, you're doing this variety show at Rouge Cat this Sunday at 6 o'clock. Now, what kind of acts are you having? I know Jono Manson is going to be there, the wonderful, wonderful musician.
Yeah, you know, one thing, I've always wanted musicians for 9 months, and it's been a little hard. We've had some folks, but between the setup time for musicians and everything else and just having the connection. So I've known Jono for years and saw him at Lucky Bean. Lucky Bean had a meeting of the Santa Fe Music Alliance that's launching. And so I said, "Hey, we got this variety show." That was a few months ago. And then I wrote him just before Thanksgiving, and he wrote a few days later, "Hope I'm not too late. I'd love to do your show," which really is an honor. And that, you know, that's for him something that he's helping with the community too. And also the lure for all performers is a chance in front of an audience, but a chill audience that's looking for some spontaneity, is to try new things. So Jono has been saying that, you know, he looks forward to. He broke out his banjo, you know, when we were on a different show, fortunately, and plans to do things. He doesn't really play banjo. So it's a chance. Of course, he can do it well.
Right.
So it's a chance for him to present new or old material or something he's never done. And that goes for all the performers. So the other stuff we have is our reading. And then we started a few months ago.
Now, is your reading the Monty Python Brigade Squadron?
No, I was going to. That's what I was about to say.
Okay.
Started a few months ago. I grew up on Monty Python.
Yes, as many of us did.
Yeah, a lot of us did. And I had the idea to try to do some sketches. And the first month, a few months ago that we did it, I was scared of, like, is this sacrilege? You know, and we did it, and the audience loved it. So now we're developing where I think what I want to have the format is we do, at the beginning of the show, one that you know, we've read a few times together, but that we're working on. And the end of the show is one that's developed. And so for this month, we're going to end the show with the ending of Life of Brian, Always Look on the Bright Side of Life, including the crucifixes, which we're building. So there's that. And then sort of a reading, but it's not going to be the first time we read it, of the parrot sketch.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, and the Python thing, too, is open to people who are brave enough, I suppose, or to try that with us, too. So, you know, one thing is I'm proud about is that the performers mentioned that they keep coming each month of all sorts of performers that is beginning to feel like a troupe, and they look forward to it as much as I do and some audience members. And I want to emphasize that the troupe is open for other people to come in every month.
So theater, poetry, fiction, slam hybrid, dance, music, fun, surprises. What is slam hybrid?
That I put on there was somebody was going to do some slam or did, but wanted to make sure they didn't want to get stigmatized by the slam thing. So we was like, oh, it's a slam hybrid. Just, you know, it ties in.
It's like half electric, half gas.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, it ties in with the whole format of the show, which is experiment. You know, if you want, please do. So, yeah. And then this month we do actually have three slam performers trying a little bit. You know, hopefully the slam for me will be quick and short and great. You know, and then we have some authors each month that present, quick, short material too. The thing about an author is, you know, we don't want the it's not meant as just a reading. So, you know, in the world of great authors too, or published or whatever, it's a bit rare that a author is a great performer. So ones that are welcome to do something longer, and the ones that aren't, you know, present something short. You know, a piece of something. And also one thing that's developing with the troupe sensibility is serialized. You know, I did it from the start with the Jules Works play, but other people are doing that where you present a little bit of the material each time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Now, you are going to be going on, there are dates in January and February, so it really is a monthly variety show, and pretty soon you'll be hitting a year.
We hit a year in March, and it's pretty much going to be the last Sunday of the month, I think. You know, after Rouge Cat, if that goes well, we'll stick there. If not, you know, we'll see. It's stressful to be a floating show, but it's also kind of cool. So it always comes together. Just like years ago with the film festival, we call it the miracle that happens. So,
right.
You know, when people want to do stuff, it happens, even though, you know, for some reason I wind up being the one that you carry more of the stress, if you know. But people are really helping. So, yeah, we have those dates in March. I think would be the last Sunday. There'll be exceptions when there's holidays or things. It was April I looked at, and maybe even March, where it looked like it makes more sense to do, because those months have five Sundays, the fourth Sunday.
Right. Well, we'll talk about that when the time comes.
Yes.
So it's the Santa Fe Monthly Variety Show called the Jules Works Follies. Stephen Rubin, also known as Jules, is the producer of this thing, and you are one of the performers as well. John O'Manson, musician, will be there. Andrew Kirkpatrick is the host, and Tone Forrest will be there, even though it's after Christmas, doing a little bit of holiday musical cheer.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I wanted to. Yeah, yeah, because that's fun and just, you know, joyous and a little bit of a counterpart to always look on the bright side of life.
Well, Stephen Rubin, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe, and congratulations on hitting almost a year of this variety show, and we'll keep people up to date.
Oh, and we're going to do in late April, I don't like calling it a best of, but that's the easiest way, a showcase.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So the things that have gone best over the course of the last year will be developed.
And we're soliciting the audience's input on that as well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
And by the way, we are obviously not having Speaking of the Arts today, but be sure to pick up your Positiempo Friday Arts Supplement in the Santa Fe, New Mexican, and find out all the fabulous New Year's Eve stuff that is going on. Thank you so much for listening, everybody, and Happy New Year.